Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Is crypto perfect? Nope. But neither was email when it was invented in 1972. And yet today, we send 347 billion emails every single day. Crypto is no different. It's new, but like email, it's also revolutionary. With Kraken, it's easy to start your crypto journey with 24/7 support when you need it. Go to kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures, Inc. PVI DBA Kraken. Visit PVI's disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Global with me, Chris Jones. In August 2021, the Taliban retook the power it had lost in Afghanistan and succeeded in setting up a government of sorts. Since that moment, a lot has changed, especially for women. Banned from work, banned from universities, even banned from national parks. Life in Afghanistan for women under the Taliban has fast become a prison. New leader Habibullah Akhundzadeh released a message not long ago in which he said, "The status of women as a free and dignified human being has been restored." I'm joined now by someone who knows that to be a lie and has experienced the oppression women face in Afghanistan and has fought against it at great length, irrespective of her own safety. Pashtona Durrani is an educator and the founder of Learn Afghan, an organization that does many things, including helping to give Afghan girls and women the education they deserve. Pashtona, thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Excellent. I want to start off by giving a bit more background on this from your perspective, because you were in Afghanistan when the Taliban retook control. What do you remember from that time?
I think many people forget the fact that Kandahar was under siege for 3 months before it was taken over, and Kabul fell in one day. So people tend to be like, oh, August 15 was the day everything happened. But for us, the whole summer was horrifying because people were coming in from all these districts that were being bombed, and the Taliban were capturing it and actually assassinating people who were working with the military or the police. And people were ending up in Aino Mena, or like the main city of Kandahar. And you could see that we had become a refugee nation in our own country. People were being murdered. I remember the last 4 weeks of that siege was me getting calls from all my relatives. Oh, this person died today. He was murdered. His body is still not found. His head was found. So I think sometimes I would want to remember those people, because it doesn't do them justice that they were murdered for something that was so meaningless. Yeah.
And specifically for women, what has life been like since? I know you say that, and this has been going on for a long time now, especially in certain areas of Afghanistan, but broadly since 2021, what's life been like for women in Afghanistan?
It's like, I tell people again and again, I'm like, it's like when you wake up in your own countries, it doesn't matter what country you're from. People tend to think when it comes to Afghanistan, so it's a conflict zone, people might be used to it.
Yes. But
it's very much like if you wake up in the US today, you have all the rights you have. Tomorrow, you're not allowed to leave your house, not go to school, not study, not be in any political representative space. And a group of terrorists take that space, people who murdered your family members, people who shut down your schools, bombed your schools, people who targeted NGOs and nonprofits. And all of a sudden, you go from being part of that country to being shunned in your own country. So I think that's the sort of analogy I would like to give. It's because Afghanistan has been a war zone, people tend to forget like, oh, we still had a constitution. Yes, there was corruption. Yes, there were people who were bad. Yes, there were politicians who were doing all of those weird stuff. But then at the same time, constitutionally, we have the right to go to school. Like, no, we don't even have a constitution. We have a bunch of terrorists who are running the country. So there's this sort of understanding that you have to have when it comes to Afghanistan. Life has changed, but life has been upside down, I think, for Afghan women, especially young Afghan women who didn't grow up in during the Taliban regime. For them, all of a sudden, now they're 21, 22, and they're not allowed to finish their last semester of med school or go to public school or talk to a friend, go to a cafe, or breathe the fresh air in a park, you know?
Yeah, I listed in the intro just three of the bans that have been brought in place for women in Afghanistan. And they just seem, for someone in my country, just impossibly unfair and endless. Do you think you could explain, just to simplify it for us, what kind of education that women in Afghanistan are allowed access to? And then also, what is the Taliban's reasoning for not allowing certain levels of education for women?
First of all, let's talk about what is allowed right now for Afghan women to be allowed as a person who reproduces. I think that's the main activity that is seen right now. The education minister said that openly, that education is a Western tool. We don't want to do it in Afghanistan. Then what sort of education is allowed? I wouldn't even say even religious education to some extent is not allowed. So when people are like, oh no, but women go to madrasas. No, if you hit puberty or if you start menstruating, then you are not going to madrasa either. So you have to understand right now, the level of education when it comes to access legally is zero. It's none. So you cannot go to public school. Only to a certain extent, if you're a young girl, between the age of like 0 to 10. So you can go to until grade 3 and then you're not allowed to be in that public vicinity or space, and your government or regime doesn't provide for any of the facilities to access that. Post that, if you're in high school, if you were in high school, if you're in secondary, elementary, graduate, postgraduate, any sort of those circumstances, you're supposed to sit at home and wait for the regime to change or change their mind. So that's the sort of education that we are looking at. And at the same time, there is not even, because there are people who are doing PhDs in religious studies, women, they're not allowed to go to those spaces either to do it. So right now, that is a very restricted sort of lifestyle that we are dealing with. And then when it comes to why are the Taliban not allowing it? I mean, we cannot expect people who bombed schools for the past two decades. Mm. We cannot expect from people who came with the propaganda, schools are created by infidels, funded by infidels, and they are going to turn the country into a bad or dishonored space. We cannot expect them to open schools. Their own people are going to, desert them. So I think for us, we have to understand they're caught between this, yes, I am ruling the country, so I might want something progressive, which they don't, by the way. But then again, on the other hand, if I do this, people are going to leave me because the propaganda I did for the past two decades, I would justify burning schools down. How can I just let it be open now, you know? And last but not the least, ideologically, they don't believe in women's rights or educational rights or girls' rights. So it would challenge them, you know? Now, coming more to practical terms, like, certain groups want education. Certain groups might want education only as a project that is funded by the foreigners or other countries so that they can get a commission out of it or money out of it. Only then they might allow it because they have been to Kabul now. They have seen the SUVs. They have seen Wazir Akbar Khan. They have seen all this lavish lifestyle, you know. So they want it to continue. But I personally would think, you know how leaders are always elected on these models, free healthcare or like education and stuff like that. Yeah. For them, they came into power by justifying the fact that burning schools is okay. Girls should be at home. Women should be at home. There is no space for them and we don't accept them. So it would be very hard for them to ideologically accept it or promote it or make it part of their policies.
I think I saw a stat that said that around about 96% of all women in Afghanistan right now are suffering from mental stress, from severe mental illness because of what the Taliban has put in place, not just on schools, but in society as well. So from what you've said, is it fair to say that it feels like a lot of women in Afghanistan feel like their future, but also their present, has been stolen from them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was stolen by corrupt politicians, the West in general, people who lobbied for them, for the journalist, for the female journalist who went to Doha, covered these Taliban, made them humans, were fascinated by the fact that the Taliban would talk to a woman in skirt while her legs were showing. It's all of them stealing the future of Afghan women. Right now, Afghan women are fighting against an extreme form of religious extremism that is put in place. By the way, they're also the only people who are fighting for religious justice, because Islam doesn't say that. Our culture doesn't say it. So for us, it's like we're fighting for what the religion says or what our culture has taught us. These are the people who are foreign with their concepts, you know. But then at the same time, yeah, the future was stolen. Their present is stolen. And they are the victims of political agenda in which they didn't have a part. You know, what would a 14-year-old has to do with something that the Taliban had to do with, you know? But they are the victims. They're the first victims, you know. Here's the funny thing. The Taliban do welcome the corrupt politicians back into the country. They receive them on red carpets. They're welcoming them in private jets and everything. But that 14-year-old girl in a random district of Afghanistan is someone the Taliban are choosing to be at war with right now.
Not having, you know, essentially half of the population in education, what does that mean in wider society in terms of jobs? Surely, you know, the economy, everything will suffer, surely.
I mean, in pragmatic terms, if you're looking at Afghanistan right now, Afghanistan is going to have a setback, is having a setback. You don't have young girls graduating from... I hate the fact that I have to justify their education. Yeah. Into medical school, that if they get graduated, then they are going to save lives. That's why we need them. No, we need education in general. But at the same time, right now we don't have midwives who have graduated in the past 2 years. By the way, we don't have doctors who have graduated in this year. We don't have nurses. By the way, this is a country that has been at war for the past 4 decades, has been at war for the active war for the past 2 decades, and doesn't have a lot of healthcare infrastructure. So right now, that moment of breathing that we have is not even put to use. So you don't have all of that. But then at the same time, you don't have political representatives, so you don't know what half of your population is thinking in reality.
Yeah.
Then you come to economics. So if there is no doctor who is going to see your patients in your country, people are going to flee to Iran or Pakistan. And how does that help us? That helps us in a way that we are losing our businesses, including healthcare, education, or anything of that sort. All these countries where if they're seeking healthcare, they're going to go and pay for that in another country. So you're losing all that business too. And most importantly, if many of the fathers that love their daughters wouldn't want to stay in the country, so they would move to another country and they would consider that. And if a father is moving, so he's going to work in that country. He's going to pay taxes in that country. And you lose all this brain power and you become a country with like brain drain, you know? So if you're not going to make it easy for families to exist in Afghanistan, people are going to choose your family over you, you know, and that's the reality. In Taliban's mind, it's like they think only men is the family and they matter. But for a lot of people, their daughters matter, their sisters matter. I can give you a very small example. 100 girls every day attend school at Kandahar, which is like right now being vilified and everything. 100 girls mean 100 fathers, 100 mothers, possibly like 300 brothers, because even in on average, Afghan families are big. So all of that, all of them know that they're going and they want to do this. And if that was not a possibility, I'm pretty sure they would have moved or they would have sent their daughter away. So you have to understand all of those things. It's not just healthcare. It's not, we have to save lives. It's economics, it's business, it's taxes. And it's, for God's sake, it's your own citizen that you're alienating in the process.
And I want to talk about that a little bit in terms of safety as well, because I remember around about 2 years ago, I spoke to you and, for example, you couldn't tell me where you were because, you know, fears of your own safety. And that is still a reality for a lot of educators, especially in Learn Afghan, which you founded. There are a lot of people who fight against, I think is the right word, this legislation and do want to send their daughters to get an education. And those women also want to go and get an education. So how dangerous is it, not just for those fathers, for those mothers, for the women themselves, but for educators as well in Afghanistan? How much danger do they face of being found out basically by the Taliban?
I mean, look at the number of activists missing in Afghanistan right now, and their main activities. What they did was like, oh, they were education activists. They were educators. Even the world doesn't, and the UN, by the way, doesn't recognize our educational crisis as a humanitarian crisis or a human rights abuse crisis. They still think it's an infrastructural issue or a political issue, but it is political and human rights abuse issue. The activists that are missing in Afghanistan, Visa, a lot of other activists that have been gone missing in the past 2 years are because of their affiliation with schools, with secret schools, with educational policies, with advocating for education. That's the only reason. So, A, it has to be recognized. B, that's the reason people are going missing. Our own school, we had to change it like 7 times just because people thought, or our teachers thought, that they were being surveilled whenever they left the vicinity. So everybody is scared, but it doesn't mean that they have to stop it. They will navigate around it or through it, but they won't stop at it, you know?
You mentioned it slightly there about the United Nations and their stance on this. Do you think that the international community, well, I think I know the answer to this, but do you think they're doing enough here to condemn what the Taliban are putting in place?
I think it's less about condemning. It's more about like what they can do and what they show that they do, you know?
Yeah.
Every time somebody goes missing or every time there is a ban, the first day, all these people from the US State Department to Amina Mohammed, to the UN, to anyone and everyone, post this big tweet. Oh, we're sorry, this is happening in Afghanistan and we feel bad for it. We hope it's reversed and everything. And then the second day, there's some news about it. And the third day, nothing. People move on. The international community has moved on. If they had been serious about Afghanistan, first of all, I personally do think that the international community doesn't care about Afghanistan. For them, we are a poverty porn project, where the less fed we are, the more poor we are, the less educated we are, the more jobs we generate for them in humanitarian industry for them to feed us and for them to take care of us and for them to raise funds on our behalf. But on the other hand, at the same time, if we look at the reality of what they can do, they can sanction the Taliban leaders who are doing this, can stop their families from having access to all the luxuries in the world, in the Middle East and in South Asia, in countries that they are. They can also stop their families from accessing all the money that they have accumulated over the course of these years. So, why, A, you're not sanctioning their bank accounts, you're not sanctioning their travel. They're not sanctioning their families. Their families are traveling. Their families are getting educated. Their families have access to all the money that they want. So are they really in this conflict with the Taliban? Because from what I see is a right-wing party from Norway went to Afghanistan and met with the Taliban. And they were okay with it. They were smiling and taking pictures. The UN has taken pictures. Amina Mohammed went on to say that the Taliban are willing to talk about stuff. But at the same time, I was like, okay, lose your passport, go to Afghanistan, all with your grandchildren, then we'll talk. Right now, we cannot talk. We're not in the same shoes. They think if Taliban are talking to women, that's good enough. They're talking to you. When they talk to an Afghan woman, they won't have the same sort of personality that you see. So, yeah, no, I have a lot of conflict when it comes to the community. Yeah,
and then just finally, from when I've spoke to you last to speaking to you now and to seeing, you know, all of the interviews and the talks and the things that you've written about, one thing that I really get from you is that you hold on to this burning hope, this hope that, you know, things will get better and things will change. I guess you have to hold on to that feeling, otherwise, what else have you got, right?
Yeah, what else have I got? That's the reality. I'm studying education because I want to go back to Afghanistan and work on that. I hope that there is a day where we don't need more NGOs like LEARN or the UN to help us rescue Afghanistan. But I also personally believe that no more rescuing, you know? We don't need to be rescued. we just need to build our future. So for me, I will always hope. I'm a hopeless optimist when it comes to Afghanistan. I believe in an Afghanistan in my head, actually, that is much better than what we see right now. And it has been better in the past. So I would definitely believe in that. But then at the same time, when time comes, right now we're in this preparing mode. When time comes, we wouldn't need the world to come and rescue us, to weaponize us. Oh, we need to save Afghan women. That time, we'll have our own people who will be educated enough to do that. Even if it's in secret right now, even if it's illegal right now, you have to hold on to it. I mean, what else have we got in this tiny world, you know?
Pashtana, thanks so much for talking to me and giving me some of your time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, we've got well over 1,000 other conversations just like this on The Bunker. And the best news is that we make a new one every day. We're normal people doing our best to make extraordinary podcasts. So if you enjoy what we do and want more, why not back us on Patreon? Just £3 a month will help keep us going for another 1,000 episodes. For that, you'll get access to some pretty sweet merch and a chance to listen to our episodes ad-free before everyone else. I'm Chris Jones, reporting from The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Roz Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Roz Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Global was written and presented by Chris Jones. The producer was Liam Tate, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker Global is a Podmasters production.